China will pay the price of tariffs. That's the premise of President Trump's trade war. But tell that to Robert Ozarski. He says the tariffs are killing his business.
I had product in the pipeline. I couldn't, what was I going to do? I had paid for that product. Hopefully I can squeeze the cost down enough where I can continue.
Now the trade talks with China are starting back up. I'm Marco Werman. Also this hour, a Dutch city is building green bus shelters that encourage bees to hang around.
It's more or less a bit exciting to wait on the bus and enjoy a bit of biodiversity.
Pollinator-friendly bus stops. Plus, American and Mexican kids are sharing bright pink seesaws that are perched on the border wall itself. Cross-border cooperation. That story and much more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. President Trump got busy on Twitter early today. This time, his primary target, China. China is doing very badly, Trump wrote. The president's social media attack comes just as China and the U.S. are set to resume negotiations on trade. Trump accused China of slow-walking a deal, hoping to wait it out until after the 2020 election for a possible different deal with a Democrat-like sleepy Joe Biden, as he wrote in that tweet. But the president also predicted that he will win re-election and that the longer these talks grind on, the tougher things will be for China. Joining me now is The World's Jason Margolis. So you've been covering this trade war with China since it started. Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin and U.S. Trade Representative Robert Lighthizer are meeting with Chinese leaders in Shanghai today and tomorrow. Why is Trump tweeting today about the Chinese waiting things out for Joe Biden?
Basically, he's putting pressure on them. He's saying, negotiate with me now, or you're going to be in a much tougher spot when I'm reelected in 2020. And one of his tweets, he said, we have all the cards.
This is not the first Twitter attack by Trump aimed at China. How could all of this make negotiations at this point even more difficult?
Well, that's a good question. We were just talking about this in the newsroom. It's a bit like going into a car salesman and saying, I don't like you. Now let's negotiate.
Right.
I mean, on the one hand, you're a tough guy and maybe it sets them back on the heels. On the other hand, the car dealer might say, well, no, I'm not going to deal with you. So it depends on who you ask.
And just remind us what the key sticking points are in these negotiations.
Well, the key sticking point today is agricultural sales. China promised it would buy more crops from the United States. China says it's in the process of doing that. Trump says, no, you haven't done that. Some of the other big things are intellectual property. China has long been accused of forcing American companies to transfer the technology in order to do business in China. And President Trump wants to balance trade between the two countries. We buy a lot more stuff from China than they buy from us. President Trump wants to even that out.
Is there any possibility of a breakthrough this week?
No.
That's it.
No. Hard stop, no. But here's the thing. Trump claims he doesn't care. Let's listen to him on Friday.
I don't know if they're going to make a deal. Maybe they will, maybe they won't. I don't care because we're taking in tens of billions of dollars worth of tariffs.
So he's talking about taking in tariffs or taxes at the border?
Correct. Trump often claims that tariffs are taking in a lot of revenue for the U.S. government. But recent data says the U.S. has taken in about $21 billion, and that's a drop in the bucket for the amount of revenue that the U.S. government takes in. And it's not even enough to cover the $28 billion that Trump has promised to farmers for all the sales that they've lost because of this trade war. And let me play a little bit more from President Trump on Friday.
I don't personally care that much because we're getting billions and billions. Remember this, the people aren't paying for it. Everyone says people pay for it.
And I wanted to play that tape because Trump brings that up a lot. He says Americans aren't paying for this. It's China who is feeling the pain of this trade war. But that's not true. American companies and entrepreneurs are having to pay that tax at the border. And studies have shown that American consumers are paying more for our products. So while China is feeling some pressure from the trade war, the additional cost of the tariffs is being borne by you and me, American consumers, and by American companies.
So here at The World, we've been looking at the real-life consequences of the U.S.-China trade war and some companies and people that have been caught in the middle of that trade war. Today, Jason, you've got the story of one entrepreneur with a tiny startup. So let's hear some of that reporting from San Diego.
When Robert Ozarski turned 60, he had a massive heart attack. His doctors told him he needed more exercise. So he decided to become a regular cyclist. Small problem. Where to store his bike in his cluttered garage.
And when I started wanting to use my bike regularly, I did what is the normal thing is I went and got a hook and I would hang my bike on a hook. Because
Ozarski, who is now 71, has a high garage ceiling and had to get up on a step stool to put away his bike. This was sapping his motivation. So he bought a pulley. That didn't work so well either.
What really ended it for me is when I inadvertently, the rope slipped out of my hand while I was lowering it, and the bike will just fall, so I grab a hold of it to stop it, and I got a nasty rope burn on my hands. And I was like, okay, there's got to be a better way.
Being a retired engineer and a full-time tinkerer, Ozarski began working on his own solution.
Tug it wherever you stop, wherever you want on the way down.
Ozarski built a more refined pulley system using what's called a constant torque spring. The bike is super easy to lower and later send back up.
Pull a release cord, press down slightly on the bike, and it raises it up to the ceiling, and you're done. It's out of the way in seconds. It literally is seconds to operate.
And Ozarski realized he might have a new business on his hands. So he reached out to a bunch of U.S. manufacturers.
Mostly, I never got a response at all. And then when I did get a response, the answer was, well, yeah, sure, we'll do that. How many hundreds of thousands do you need? So it basically closed the door.
And the guts of his product are already built in China. So he starts looking to China using the Chinese website Alibaba.
So I wrote what's called an RFQ, request for quotation, and put it on Alibaba. Within 24 hours, I had 10 responses from companies in China that said, well, here is our process of how we do this, and this is what it'll cost, and here's when you pay, et cetera, et cetera.
And in China, they were willing to make him 100 units to see if his devices would actually sell. He says it's been a great relationship. So he opened up his retirement savings.
$250,000. Yeah, it's a lot of money.
His new company is called Cradle with a K. All was going well, and then President Trump slapped tariffs on $250 billion worth of Chinese-made goods coming into the U.S. Ozarski's invention made the list.
It comes under the heading of a lifting device.
Ozarski was forced to pay a 10% tax to the U.S. government at the Port of Los Angeles. In May, that tax went up to 25%. And he quickly realized he could no longer sell his device for $140 and turn a profit. He raised his price $9, but it's not enough. And he just isn't sure how much further he can go.
I mean, you can buy a hook for, you know, $5, and you can buy some of these pulley mechanisms for $20. Now, they don't do the same thing. So how much value add does the convenience of this product provide?
Ozarski is asking his Chinese suppliers to lower their prices, and he's been looking again to U.S. manufacturers, but has run into the same problems as before. Ozarski isn't a fan of President Trump, but some members of his family are, and he doesn't like to talk politics. Still, I asked him what he thought of President Trump's overall tariff strategy.
I try to be above the fray, but I think it's the wrong approach. If you wanted to say, okay, I need to do something because I think trade is unfair, all right, fine. But understand that the impact that you have is enormous on existing and certainly on a startup business. In my case, I had product in the pipeline. What was I going to do? I had paid for that product. Hopefully I can squeeze the cost down enough where I can continue. And I'm going to run against that decision fairly soon because of the lead time for the product. So I'm going to have to either fish or cut bait, as they say.
And if you cut bait, then you have basically a $250,000 pulley system in your garage.
That's right. I have a $250,000 pulley system in my garage. And it's, yeah, it'll become in the category of bad decisions.
For The World, Jason Margolis, San Diego.
Normally, a day like today might be a moment of togetherness for many Americans. The 400th anniversary of the first Democratic Assembly by colonists in Jamestown, Virginia. But the anniversary seemed to highlight some of our divisions. President Trump spoke today in Jamestown, but African-American lawmakers in Virginia boycotted the speech, calling Trump an emblem of hate. That's a reference to Trump's recent attacks on Elijah Cummings, the Democratic congressman from Maryland, as well as other attacks like the ones from Trump and his supporters calling for Somali-American lawmaker Ilhan Omar from Minnesota to go back home.
It's kind of scary waking up in the U.S. these days.
That's Abdi Iftin. He escaped Somalia in 2011. He now lives in Yarmouth, Maine. Iftin says the political rhetoric these days is sending chills through the Somali American community.
Being a Somali means being a Muslim, a person of color, a refugee, which Ilhan is, which I am, which millions of Somalis are. And the conversation within the Somali community is a bit positive if you look at the younger girls now growing up and they see Ilhan in office, first Somali woman, Minnesota legislature, and now made it all the way to the Congress. So somehow there's hope within the younger generation, the community. And then there's also confusion and uncertainty in terms of what this really means, what the politicians are saying. When, for instance, a senator says he's going to buy Ilhan a ticket, she needs to go back to Somalia. To me, America was an idea that fits everyone. So it's quite disappointing. And I think that's not the America that not only me, thousands and thousands of other young generation growing up in war zones in Somalia or in Yemen or other places have to dream about.
I mean, Somali Americans are not a new target for President Trump. In 2016, candidate Trump spoke on the campaign trail in Maine, where you live now.
So we've just seen many, many crimes getting worse all the time. And as Maine knows, a major destination for Somali refugees, we admit hundreds of thousands, you admit, into Maine and to other places in the United States, hundreds of thousands.
Yeah, and by the way, it's not hundreds of thousands. But anyway, in Minnesota, home to the largest Somali American community, Trump's attacks in 2016 were even more pointed.
Here in Minnesota, you've seen firsthand the problems caused with faulty refugee vetting, with large numbers of Somali refugees coming into your state without your knowledge, without your support or approval, and with some of them then joining ISIS and spreading their extremist views all over our country and all over the world.
So it's 3 years later now, and the attacks have not stopped. Does it feel worse this time around or more of the same?
2016 was a feeling of being caught off guard. We were so confused. We were not quite sure what to do with it. But I think we had done a great job as a community by standing up and sending Ilhan, for instance, for her to go up to Congress. But we were not expecting that the only Somali politician and the woman who has made it to Congress would be sort of bullied. And we don't know where this will end.
Congresswoman Omar has been outspoken and controversial. Some might even say confrontational. Do some people in the Somali American community feel that she should not be so vocal?
Yes. You know, you can sometimes hear people saying, you know, we didn't want her to talk about these issues and these issues. We want her to focus on pacifying places like Somalia or talking about issues like that. And, you know, for instance, I think the issues that Ilhan has really tweeted about regarding Israel and the Jews and all that within the community, you know, it's something we do not want her to be caught up in the middle of. So I think somehow the Somali community feel that she, you know, she's the representative of the Somali diaspora. Mm. But also Ilhan sees herself as representative of the Americans who voted her up. So yes, I think there's some members of the Somali community would not want her to be so vocal. You know, we want Ilhan to focus on how she could do something for the Somalis and Somalia. But also, she's a strong woman. That's who she is, and that's how she does things. But for us, not politicians, regular Somalis, we're driving around. We go to coffee shops. You know, we hang out. We are at Walmart. We're doing our regular things. We don't have bodyguards or anything like that. And Ilhan had received death threats. So those death threats are things that scare Somalis because you could be targeted.
Abdi Iftin's memoir is called Call Me American. He lives now in Yarmouth, Maine, where he works as an interpreter. Abdi, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you so much, Marco.
I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. In the Philippines, there is real tension between environmental activists and big mining companies. Local communities rely on mining to make a living. Here's what a news crew from London found out a few years ago at one underwater mine in the Philippines.
Driven by poverty and hunger, they stop at nothing to dig out a few flecks of precious metal, including risking the lives of their children.
Sending those children diving sometimes for underwater gold. In some cases, mining companies have gone to extremes to stop environmental and community activists who try to disrupt the mining operations. The personal risks of being an activist in the Philippines is highlighted in a new report today by the group Global Witness. It names the Philippines as the most dangerous place to be an environmental activist. Last year, 164 activists there were killed, according to the group. J.B. Garganera is the national coordinator of Alianza Tigil Mina, the Alliance Against Mining, based near Manila.
Being an activist is already difficult in general here in the Philippines. Being an environmental activist puts some additional challenges in the work. When we go down south, where most of the mines are located, the challenge of martial law in the Mindanao region poses additional risks. The presence of military in many of the communities affected by mines or logging or plantations are easily justified. And so when you have opposition to these projects, it's easy for local communities to be tagged as bandits or rebels or communist insurgents. And that adds another layer of complications to local communities.
And have you, as an activist, ever been threatened? Can you talk about maybe one episode?
Yes, I've had several strange calls and even death threats. The most recent and the scariest one happened about 2 years ago when the caller actually mentioned my car, the brand, the color, and my plate number. And of course, I asked them, why are they doing that? And they said, why are you wondering? Because you're up against powerful and big players here with your what you're doing. But, you know, what I've experienced is a very small incident of harassment compared to the daily threats and challenges faced by communities who day in and day out have to face the large-scale mining company or the power plant or the large plantation owner.
So there were more than 150 land defenders and environmental activists killed last year in the Philippines. I want to know more about who's behind that. Let's start at the top. We know Rodrigo Duterte, the president, has taken a zero-tolerance approach to drugs. What are his feelings about environmental activism?
Well, as president, he has given the impression that he's an environmentalist, but he has not been able to stop one single mine. And so you have this signal from the president that human rights is a low priority, and that is sending the message to large business interests that those who are opposing mining or opposing logging or opposing plantations, they're open season to be intimidated and harassed and eventually be silenced.
Are you saying that the perpetrators are somehow connected to the mining companies or to the military stationed in these mining communities? And how do you know that?
We do have two cases that have been documented. One is up north in a mine owned by Oceana Gold. And this mining contract has expired a month ago, but it's still operating. The other case down in Mindanao actually resulted in a military court being convened because of the involvement of the military in the murder of the family of a leading indigenous person who was leading the anti-mining campaign.
What keeps you motivated as an environmental activist in the Philippines?
Oh, well, my exposure during college was really working with indigenous peoples, and I saw how beautiful our natural resources were. I want to be able to tell my grandchildren we did something to prevent total environmental destruction.
J.B. Garganera, an environmental activist and the national coordinator for the Filipino environmental group Alianza Tigil Mina, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Still on the environment beat with a solution story now. Bees, we know, are important pollinators, but some bee populations are under serious threat. A city in the Netherlands has come up with a unique response. It's turning bus shelters into bee sanctuaries.
Our bus shelters, it's like they have a small, about 6 square meter garden on top of them.
Maurice Price is with the city of Utrecht, southeast of Amsterdam. He says more than 300 of the city's bus stops have been topped off with these green roofs over the past few months.
It's a very clever design in which the rainwater will also go into that roof. And when there's just too much water in it, it will just flow away on a very natural way. So we don't need that many maintenance.
How have bus riders responded to these new shelters, not to mention everybody else?
very, very, very positive. Everybody really likes it because the decrease of bee population, everybody feels responsible for it. And on the other hand, people say it also looks very, very nice. It's more exciting to wait on the bus and stand under a green roof and enjoy a bit of biodiversity because of that.
So this is fairly new. Is there any way to determine what effect these bus shelters, these green bus shelters, have had so far on the environment in Utrecht or biodiversity?
No, not yet. It's hard to detect at the moment, but we will work very closely with the university to maintain everything very well.
Are you at least hearing bees buzzing around as you're waiting for the bus?
No, not yet. Not yet at the moment. Probably we will see one or two, but I cannot conclude that they are they're back in again.
So are these green bee bus shelters, is this a Utrecht idea? Did you get this from somewhere else?
No, it's a 100% Utrecht idea. So it's very unique. And we got a lot of very nice comments from Utrecht, from our region, from our country, from Europe, and also from around the world.
What about other efforts to make Utrecht more bee-friendly?
What we will do at the end of this year, we will have the largest bee hotel in the world.
Now, bee hotel?
Bee hotel.
What does that mean?
We will establish a very large building which will attract bees. So we are not going to release bees. No, it has to be a very natural way. And we want to make the bee hotel and the surroundings as bee-friendly as possible to attract and to give bees a very proper living over there.
And what would be the goal of a bee hotel working at this kind of scale?
Our goal will be that we will have a nice and proper amount of bees in our city to work on the biodiversity.
Yeah, so it sounds like the bus shelter is just a starting point. Is Utrecht like the big city of bees now?
Probably it is. Probably it is.
Maurice Price with the city of Utrecht, the Netherlands. Thank you very much. Good luck.
Okay, thank you very much.
For 30 years, the INF kept nuclear weapons in check, but that treaty comes to an end on Friday.
When something like the INF treaty goes down the drain, almost like nothing, that shows you the degree to which people have forgotten the power of these weapons.
I'm Marco Werman, and that story coming up shortly here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH, PRI, and PRX. Kind of audacious to make a comedy about an accidental nuclear war. Stanley Kubrick did it in 1964 with Dr. Strangelove.
Listen, I mean, it's not going to help either one of us if the doomsday machine goes off now, is it?
Peter Sellers, as the U.S. president there, trying to talk his Soviet counterpart into not launching a retaliatory nuclear strike.
Dimitri, there's no point in you getting hysterical at a moment like this.
In real life, it took the U.S. and the Soviet Union decades to stand down and bring the Cold War to an end. One key piece of that was the signing of the INF Treaty in 1987. The Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty eliminated an entire class of nuclear missiles. But as of this Friday, the INF Treaty is no more. The Trump administration announced its withdrawal last year. August 2nd is the effective date. From Moscow, here's Charles Maines with a look at the start and end of the INF.
In December 1987, U.S. President Ronald Reagan hosted Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev at the White House in a ceremony that signaled the changing times.
And the treaty we're signing today are both excellent examples of the rewards of patience.
Reagan, who'd once labeled the USSR the evil empire, was all smiles with the Soviet reformer while introducing the reason they were all there, to sign the Intermediate Range Nuclear Weapons Treaty.
My Mr. General Secretary, though my pronunciation may give you difficulty, the maxim is, dovayai no provayai, trust but verify.
Назначение этого...
На каждой встрече вы это повторяете.
You repeat that at every meeting.
It was a momentous occasion. Gorbachev comes to Washington. Of course, he's a rock star type guy.
Reagan's Secretary of State George Shultz was in the room that day and helped craft the deal that came to be known as the INF Treaty. At 98, Shultz is still active as a fellow at Stanford's Hoover Institution. He says the INF deal came about in part because of a shift in Reagan's thinking. The president had come to believe nuclear war was not only unwinnable, but that nuclear weapons were immoral.
Where is it written that a man can press a button and kill a million people? That's God. And in Gorbachev, he met a person who had a similar view.
As Gorbachev talked up the historical importance of the INF Treaty, Pavel Poroshenko looked on. A Soviet diplomat who served as Gorbachev's English interpreter, he'd overseen years of failed arms control negotiations. So Poroshenko, he was in a good mood.
Definitely a huge step forward. Two great nations, two superpowers, nuclear superpowers, have finally been able to stop the race in at least two categories of nuclear weapons, intermediate and shorter range missiles.
Now, of course, the U.S. and USSR were still armed to the teeth. Both still had nuclear weapons capable of destroying the other, with plenty left over to take the rest of the planet with them. But George Shultz says the INF's elimination of these short and medium range nuclear weapons was critical for one key reason: time.
The time between when they're fired and when they hit is only about 10 or 11 minutes. So if you're trying to do something about it, you don't have much time. You have to probably realize they're about to be launched and try to hit them on the launching pad. People somehow now have forgotten what happens when a nuclear weapon hits.
The crisis around shortened impact time started in the mid-1970s. The Soviet Union had developed a new class of mobile medium-range nuclear missiles, the so-called SS-20s, that were capable of striking targets in Western Europe with little warning.
To be more specific, they were targeted against targets in my country, in West Germany.
That's the former chancellor of West Germany, Helmut Schmidt, in an interview with WGBH in 1987. Schmidt died in 2015. But in the interview, he talks about the pressure he put on Washington to match the Soviet SS-20 threat by coming up with its own short-range nukes.
Under the compelling threat of seeing medium-range weapons coming up over the horizon, threatening a great number of Russian cities, they would negotiate. I was absolutely convinced.
The newest improvement to the Pershing family of weapons is Pershing II.
It took a few years, but by the early 80s, the U.S. was producing its own intermediate-range weapon, the Pershing II, which the U.S. and its NATO allies deployed in West Germany on the border with communist Eastern Europe in 1984.
P-2's extended range allows NATO to counter the unilateral threat of the SS-20 missile and backfire bomber by holding at risk targets in the Soviet West.
Poroshenko, Gorbachev's aide, says the new Pershings jump-started stalled negotiations. The reason, again, time. Now it was working against the Soviets.
When Americans completed their program of deployment, then the situation became, at least on the face of it, quite different. Americans have the ballistic missiles that have the flight time to Moscow of less than 10 minutes.
10 minutes to impact amplified the risks of what some were calling a potential Hiroshima. What if something went wrong, or one side misread the other's intentions? Before, the Cold War threat consisted of missiles launched across oceans, deadly for sure, but at least they gave some time to negotiate or verify or even call off the attack. In contrast, these short and medium-range missiles just had to clear the Iron Curtain. Fear of stumbling into nuclear Armageddon gripped the European public, including a young West German singer named Nena, who recorded an anti-Cold War anthem for the Times. '99 Luftballons imagines balloons drifting accidentally into enemy airspace, triggering a world war and vast devastation. It wasn't hard for audiences to make the connection to the ongoing U.S.-Soviet standoff.
police made repeated efforts to disperse 3,000 anti-missile protesters outside the German parliament. The peace movement said this would be a non-violent expression of their opposition to missile deployment. The massive divisions in West Germany now over missile deployment.
This was the height of the anti-war movement in Europe, after all. And public opposition to housing U.S. nuclear weapons influenced the American approach to the INF negotiations, what Reagan would later call the zero option. The idea that when it came to intermediate and short-range nukes, both the U.S. and USSR wouldn't just trim their arsenals, they'd give up everything.
It was over 6 years ago, November 18, 1981, that I first proposed what would come to be called the zero option. It was a simple proposal, one might say disarmingly simple.
I know, a groaner of a joke. But George Shultz says the zero option hinged on that Russian maxim that Reagan quoted earlier, "Proверяй, но доверяй."
Trust, but verify, was the slogan. And the INF Treaty contains in it the most clear verification provisions. On-site inspection, on-site. People said we could never get that, but we did.
Over the next several years, inspectors would observe as both sides destroyed their arsenals, over 800 missiles by the U.S., and nearly double that from the Soviet side. Viktor Litovkin was a military journalist who covered the events in Russia for the daily paper Izvestia. Litovkin still remembers watching as Soviet engineers and military officers carried out the treaty's agreements, destroying missile after missile, with tears running down their cheeks.
You understand, it was their life, everything they studied for, not to kill people, but to defend their country and to make these rockets fly.
They were experiencing every parent's worst nightmare, says Litovkin. They were outliving their children. Fast forward to today, and it's the Trump administration that argues the INF Treaty has outlived its use.
Well, I think it's important first to look at the reality that the treaty was outmoded, being violated, and being ignored by other countries.
Last October, Trump's national security advisor, John Bolton, traveled to Moscow to deliver the news. The U.S. intended to leave the INF agreement amid longstanding U.S. accusations that Russia was violating the treaty. Bolton also complained that other countries that did have intermediate-range weapons, nations like China, they weren't part of the agreement.
So under that view, exactly one country was constrained by the INF treaty, the United States.
Soon, Russian President Vladimir Putin was announcing Moscow would also pull out of the deal. Barring a last-minute reprieve, the INF Treaty is set to expire August 2nd, with both sides vowing to start developing new weapons immediately. All of this has left Europe once again stuck in the middle. And again, time is on Europe's mind, says Ulrich Kuhn. He's a nuclear arms specialist in Hamburg. Only Kuhn adds that tomorrow's weapons mean even less time until impact.
Yeah. And if we talk about INF missiles in Europe, I don't want to see again, you know, the point where we have short warning times of 3 minutes. What do you want to do in 3 minutes? You can perhaps text to your loved ones and say, hey, shit hits the fan. But that's it. So I think that's, this is clearly not what we want in Europe. I'm not sure whether everyone in the U.S., particularly in the administration, has understood that.
30-some years after the initial INF treaty was signed, diplomats like Shultz worry today's politicians are too cavalier about the threat that nuclear weapons pose.
When something like the INF treaty goes down the drain, almost like nothing, that shows you the degree to which people have forgotten the power of these weapons. It's true, with the end of the Cold War, people have kind of gone to sleep on this subject. And we need to get people awake again. And if we don't, it'll be too late one of these days.
After all, good things can only happen if you keep talking, says Shultz. The last time he did it, it marked the beginning of the end of the Cold War. A nice trick, if you can repeat it. For The World, I'm Charles Maines in Moscow.
You can find out more about how leaders make decisions about nuclear weapons by playing an online game at nucleardecisions.org. Tigers are making a comeback in India. Prime Minister Narendra Modi this week announced the results of the tiger census.
The results of the just declared tiger census would make
every Indian, every nature lover happy.
The census is a massive effort with more than 20,000 cameras. It identified nearly 3,000 tigers, and that's double what the population was in India just 7 years ago. It represents nearly three-quarters of the world's tiger population. Jeanette Hemley is a conservationist with the World Wildlife Fund.
It's a very big deal, and I think it shows that whenever you've got strong political will and the right conditions, we can see recovery, and it gives us hope for tigers in the rest of Asia.
I know you spent time in India. The tiger population there, as well as the rest of the world, has been threatened for some time. Why is that, do you think?
Poaching for the illegal tiger trade, as well as habitat loss. We reached a low point probably 15 years ago in India when tiger numbers were probably at an all-time low. That was the rallying cry that really prompted the government and its partners to work together to help address the threats and to really begin the recovery, which in the end could be one of the great stories of wildlife conservation.
So what did India do to increase the population?
India has invested in the system of tiger reserves. There are now 50 across the country. It's actually increased the number in the last 20 years. Coming with that investment is employing more rangers to help patrol and protect tigers on the front lines from poaching and illegal trade. They've increased their investment in the monitoring of tigers so that we can gauge the trends. It's also invested in working closely with the communities that live next to the tiger reserves to ensure that they can benefit from tiger conservation. For example, an area that we've seen really positive developments in is with ecotourism. There are some tiger reserves in India that a portion of the funds goes back into conservation.
Human-tiger conflicts are also up. This past week, a female tiger was beaten to death by a mob of villagers in India who claim the animal attacked locals. How is India and the conservation world addressing that?
It's become a high priority for the conservation community to address this through working with villagers just to better keep their livestock, for example. Tigers obviously are big predators. They go after things like cattle or goats or sheep. It also means investing in simple ways to keep tigers away from villages. Just lighting the perimeter of a village can be enough to keep a tiger away from it at night.
Jeanette, the tiger is an important symbol for India, perhaps the symbol of India, and there's a lot of pride involved with this animal. Can you help us understand that?
You know, that goes back decades, if not centuries. And that, I think, is part of the reason we're seeing this big progress, this big milestone reached by India. We have political support at the highest levels of government in India because of that pride. And we would like to see that same kind of pride extended to the other parts of the tiger's range in Asia, where we want to see the same kind of progress.
Jeanette Hemley with the World Wildlife Fund, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Protesters in Puerto Rico can claim victory. Many have been celebrating since Governor Ricardo Rosselló announced his resignation last week. He was forced to quit after massive protests in the streets of San Juan and across the island. People were outraged over allegations of corruption, along with offensive and profane remarks from Rosselló in leaked chat messages. The governor officially steps down this Friday, but what happens next, politically speaking, is very unclear. Jorge Schmidt-Nieto is a professor of political science at the University of Puerto Rico. It's now a big puzzle around who's next in the chain of command for governor. In most states here on the mainland, the lieutenant governor would step in, but I'm not seeing that in Puerto Rico. Who would normally be next in succession?
Normally, it would be the secretary of state. That person almost acts like a lieutenant governor, except the person is not elected. But it's complicated. The whole thing is that the Secretary of State had to resign as well because he was also a member of that chat. So he and most of the close advisors that were involved in the chat, they resigned earlier. But there is a law of succession. If there is no governor and if there is no Secretary of State, then the Secretary of Justice would take over. The problem is that the current Secretary of Justice isn't any better candidate than the governor himself.
So, right, next in line, Secretary Justice Wanda Vasquez, she won't take the job, though. Why is that?
Well, initially she said she would take it, but then the public outrage demanded that she wouldn't because she has been questioned about her actions as a Secretary of Justice. She hasn't prosecuted anybody for corruption, although the federal government already made 9 arrests and has many more in line. This isn't over. She prosecuted nobody.
So the credibility of Wanda Vasquez is also questioned, and now she's not interested.
Does Wanda Vasquez really have a choice in the matter? I mean, she's still Secretary of Justice. Constitutionally, she is next in line, right?
She is next in line, but nobody can be forced to be governor. So if she doesn't resign, let's put it this way, if she doesn't resign as Secretary of Justice by Friday at 5 p.m., she would automatically become the governor. She would then have to resign, not as Secretary of Justice, but as governor.
And if she does resign, then who's next in line?
The Secretary of the Treasury, but he's not old enough to take the post. So then the next in line would be the Secretary of Education, who has also said he doesn't want the job. The next in line would be the Secretary of Labor, who she's not old enough. And then we would keep moving on to the Secretary of Transportation, Engineer Carlos Contreras, who is old enough. He was among the people who was ridiculed in the chat, in that chat that came out. So it doesn't look like it's going to go in that direction. What would solve this constitutional crisis would be a simple nomination by the governor, especially if it's somebody that's a public figure that most people know that wouldn't have to go through a long process of confirmation. And there are a couple of people who could fill that spot. But the governor, Roselló, he's keeping the country hostage for personal reasons. He's trying to avoid prosecution. So that is really his game right now. Roselló's game right now is he wants something like what Gerald Ford did to President Nixon. He wants a pardon of every and any crimes that he may have committed during his term.
Jorge, is this uncertainty over who's going to be the next governor of Puerto Rico going to drag on past this Friday? And if it does, how is the territory going to function with a power vacuum?
Well, there is a line of succession. So somebody will formally take the position. But the other potential scenario is that the governor forces the hand to a degree in which there is nobody or there appears to be nobody available and he has no choice but to stay. So I hope he doesn't do that because then he would really sink us in a serious constitutional crisis and a political crisis that we have never seen.
Jorge Schmidt Nieto, Professor of Political Science at the University of Puerto Rico. Thank you very much for your time.
My pleasure.
Finally today, President Trump's push for a border wall got a boost last week. The Supreme Court gave the go-ahead to divert $2.5 billion in military funding for wall construction. The president welcomed that decision, but some artists are working on a different project, literally straddling the border wall itself. The World's Sarah Birnbaum reports.
When you think of Trump's border wall, which sounds come to mind? Is it this?
Build that wall! Build that wall! Build that wall! Build that wall!
Or maybe this? Migrants rushing towards the border fence. Or this? Children separated from their parents. But what if it were this? It's children playing. And at one place along the border, for this moment at least, that is what's happening. The California architects Ronald Rael and Virginia Sanfratello have threaded three hot pink seesaws through a section of steel border fence near El Paso, Texas, and Ciudad Juarez, Mexico. One side of the seesaw is on the American side, the other on the Mexican side, and kids are actually seesawing through the wall.
Well, the purpose of the wall is to keep people apart and away. It's actually bringing people together in some really remarkable ways.
Rael explained the idea for the project in a TED Talk last year.
The best way to illustrate the mutual relationship that we have with Mexico and the United States is by imagining a teeter-totter where the actions on one side had a direct consequence on what happens on the other side. Because you see, the border itself is both a symbolic and literal fulcrum for U.S.-Mexico relations. And building walls between neighbors severs those relationships.
The project functions on a literal level. It literally straddles the divide. It functions on a symbolic level. It transforms an obstacle, the wall, into a site of collaboration and play. But it also functions on a visual level, When you look at an aerial view of the border fence without the seesaws, it looks like a dark line cutting through a barren landscape. The wall is cold, gray steel. Then, when you look at an aerial view of the installation, you see these three hot pink horizontal lines spanning the grayness, connecting the two sides. The pink is whimsical and fun, but it also reminds you of blood vessels, life, and those pink Valentine's Day candies. And for a second, looking at those photos, you can imagine what the border could be. For the world, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
The world's theme music was composed by Ned Porter. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, PRI, and PRX.